You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On May 31st, 1985, 2 days before her high school graduation, Sherry Smith was abducted from the driveway of her family home in South Carolina. Based on the crime scene and the abductor's repeated and taunting calls to the family, law enforcement quickly realized they were dealing with a sophisticated and highly dangerous criminal. A letter arrived the next day entitled Last Will and Testament, in which Sherry, knowing she was to be murdered, wrote bravely and achingly of her love for her parents, siblings, and boyfriend, saying that while they would miss her, she knew they would persevere through their faith. The abduction rocked her quiet town, triggering a massive manhunt and bringing in the FBI, which enlisted profiler John Douglas. A few days later, a phone call told the family where they could find Sherry's body. Then, 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick was kidnapped from her yard, confirming the harsh realization that Smith's murder was no random act. A serial killer was evolving, and the only way to stop him would be to use the study of criminal behavior to anticipate his next move before he could kill again. Douglas devised a risky and emotional fraught strategy to use Sherry's lookalike older sister Dawn as bait to draw out the unknown subject. Dawn and her parents courageously agreed. One of the most haunting investigations of Douglas's storied career, this case details how the eerily accurate profile he created, alongside his carefully crafted and stage-managed manipulation of the killer's psychology, combined with dedicated police work and cutting-edge forensic science, to end a reign of criminal terror. As Sherry's family took incredible personal risks to lure her killer from the shadows, Douglas and the FBI pushed criminal profiling to its limits, culminating in one of the most dramatic and effective confrontations with a sadistic and remorseless killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is When a Killer Calls, a haunting story of murder, criminal profiling, and justice in a small town, with my special guest, legendary criminal FBI criminal profiler and author, John Douglas. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview. John Douglas.
Hello.
Welcome to the program, John Douglas. Thank you so much for joining me.
You've been busy. You've done so many reviews. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. I've had the privilege of working with people like yourself, and it's a great thrill, and it's an honor to be able to discuss a book like When a Killer Calls with you. Let's talk about first, as you do in the book, When a Killer Calls, May 31st, 1985. And tell us a little bit about Sherry Smith and her family and what she was doing on May 31st, 1985.
Yeah. On May 31st, 1985, Sherry Faye Smith was at a pool party earlier that day with her friends and her boyfriend. And it's a Friday. And on Sunday, she's going to be graduating from high school. She'll be singing the national anthem. She had a beautiful voice. She was going to be a music major. And in looking back on the case at that time, then we learned that they were, before they came home, they were in a parking lot at a store, probably, just saying goodbye or kissing each other. But little did they know that someone was watching them. This was in Lexington, South Carolina. And so she drives home. And she gets to front of her house as a mailbox. The house sits back about 200 yards from the mailbox. Mr. Smith is in the front room. He has an office. He looks out. He sees she drives up in a little car, Chevette, and she's usually does that and checks the mail. So she's seen going to the mailbox. He really doesn't pay attention anymore. He leaves the room. He comes back about 5 to 10 minutes later, and he sees the car down there, but where is his daughter? His daughter's is not there. So he jumps in his own car and he drives down to the mailbox. The car is still turned on. Her handbag is on the front seat, passenger seat. In that handbag, besides her valuables, there's medication that she must take. She has a rare form of diabetes, and if she doesn't take that medicine, she just will become dehydrated so quickly unless she just drinks really gallons of water at a time. There's a set of footprints. She's coming from a pool party. She didn't have shoes on. Footprints from her vehicle to the mailbox, but not coming back away from the mailbox. And then there's mail on the ground in front of the mailbox. She's nowhere to be seen. And so this is how it begins. The family then, you know, contacts the police. The police right away, they think, well, you know, maybe she ran away. No, that doesn't fit the profile. The family says there's nothing, you know, she would not be a runaway. She has graduating Sunday. He's going to be singing in the national anthem. So Sheriff Metz from Lexington County Sheriff's Department, they create the biggest manhunt at that time ever, you know, in the state of South Carolina. I'm back up at Quantico, and at the time, we're not a unit yet. I'm the program manager. I have about six agents assigned to me to train them in criminal profiling. And I got these agents in 83, 84. And most of them came in 84 and beginning 85 after I nearly died on the Green River murder case. Those who read Mindhunter, right, know I collapsed on that case. I had viral encephalitis. My immune system was shot and nearly died, came home paralyzed, and had to go through rehab for months and months. At a point in my life, too, where I thought, my God, I came so close to death. Do I have what it takes anymore? Because the doctor said as they were planning to bury me that his brain has been fried to a crisp. I had such a high fever when I was in a coma. But anyway, so we get the call. And so we will provide a preliminary analysis, on the case. Not right away. It's going to be a couple of days, like within a day or so, because now the offender, I've never had a case like this in my career where the offender is calling the family. He's using some type of an electronic device, we thought, to change his voice tone and, you know, and pitch. And he is telling the family that he has Sherry, you know, and, you know, we're like together with one God and giving them hope that their daughter is alive. You know, what is the motivation? Is it ransom? No, he's not asking for money. Is it a sexual motivation? Yes, there's probably going to be a sexual motivation involved here. But why does the offender feel compelled to call the family taunt them, believing that their daughter is still alive? And so at that point in time, the undersheriff will come up to Quantico with crime scene, because what will happen next is that he will give very detailed directions where her body is found a couple of days later. And you can tell from, first you can tell from the tape, you can audio tape, you can tell that just when he speaks, he's very, very obsessive, compulsive. And when he's talking to the family, if he's interrupted, it just, he has to backtrack. He loses his train of thought. And so, but now he gives these directions to find the body of Sherry Faye Smith. He doesn't say that she's dead. He just says that, in fact, was plural, that like, we'll be there. You'll find kind of like us. We will be there. And he's telling the other sister, this Dawn, the directions. And to give such detailed directions, it's kind of reinforced the research we were conducting, how offenders will go back to the crime scenes if the victims aren't found, you know, right away for various reasons, some to symbolically roll in the dirt and relive and fantasize about the crime like Ted Bundy did and many, many, you know, others. But details, he had to go back to come up with these specific details. And so it's when, now it's her body is going to be found, and we're still, we're not dispatched down there yet, because at any given time, Dan, we're working, you know, at that time we could be working maybe a couple of hundred cases at that time. When I retired from the Bureau, we were doing 1,000 cases a year. And, wow. And these cases, let them just stay open until new leads are developed. So then now, with the death of Sherry Faye Smith, the undersheriff comes up. And what's advantageous to us is that the undersheriff and the sheriff both attended the FBI Academy's National Academy course. And it's an 11-week course that they take from police from all, they come in from all over the world to this 11-week program. It's very prestigious. They take various courses from forensic science to firearms to management courses and behavioral science. And it was in that behavioral science class that each of them took where they learned about this new investigative tool they're calling criminal profiling. And so it was because of that, they, you know, a lot of the cops, when they take that course and they see these cases, they think, I will never have anything that need this. We don't have crimes like that. Well, they did. And so he comes up and they're very open, and which will make it very easy for us to work with the police, because sometimes you're invited on cases and it doesn't necessarily mean they want you there. It's because the pressure may be put on them by the media, right, the general public, or maybe sometimes someone who attended the FBI National Academy wants you there, but you get happy working with other detectives, don't want you snooping around on their case. And just so your audience knows too, Dan, we get involved in these cases under domestic police cooperation. And it's a violation they call 62D, as in dog, 62D. And if it's a Canadian case, it'll be international police cooperation. And what you do, what you're doing here is, if we have something that another country doesn't have or a local police doesn't have, something maybe forensically, in this case, in this crime analysis, we can get involved in the case. We won't prosecute the case, but we will assist the local police. So the Lewis McCarty, the undersheriff, comes up and we listen to tapes. We see, have the crime scene, and then we start drawing up a profile based upon what evidence, what information that has developed. And these crimes, Dan, are we saw this particular one, it's going to be a white male. It showed a degree of some criminal sophistication. First, he's using a device electronically to alter his voice. Also, when we found the body, there was duct tape residue on the face of the Sherry Faye Smith's sticky substance from the duct tape. And also, her hair had been cut, and it was cut, in our opinion, to make it more easily to remove the duct tape. And the reason he removed the duct tape was because he didn't want to leave any evidence. Duct tape is a good way, whenever it's used, for the lab to develop fingerprints, latent fingerprints off of the tape. So we come up with that. We come up with an age group. Generally, when you get a case with me, I usually start off with violent crime around in the 25 age bracket. And based upon the degree and level of criminal sophistication, that we will either deduct age or increase age. So with him, with how the victim was abducted, clear daylight at her mailbox, probably the offender had some type of weapon to control, or a gun, knife to control her. So we had him placed somewhere in the late 20s into the early 30s. With someone like this, you would find a criminal history, we believe. You just don't start off perpetrating this type of crime. So there would be crimes from obscene telephone calls to voyeuristic activities to possibly other cases of abduction or attempted abduction. Based upon the device he was using electronically to alter his voice, we believe he would have he's a blue collar, have some kind of background in electrical or electronics, some type of background there. Another thing, someone I call him the ANSA, the unknown subject, would not necessarily be married. Someone like this cannot sustain a marriage. So you'll find that if he's married, it ended in divorce. Someone like this could not really survive in the military. They go in the military. Like someone, particularly at that time in the 80s and in the 70s, 80s, some of the people I interviewed, they joined for the action. They wanted to shoot people. So with Bell, we would find out later on, our offender would join the military. He didn't get assigned to anything where he's going to see any action. So supposedly he accidentally shot himself in the leg, which got him out of the military. I believe he probably shot himself purposely because he was not getting anywhere doing the things he wanted to do. Also, as we believed, as time went on, that if we get a suspect, that they'll change their appearance after the crime. What I mean by that, I mean they could, if they're heavy, they could lose weight, clean shaven, grow a beard, they have a beard, they'll get rid of the beard, try to maybe perhaps establish an alibi, as well. We're also looking, we have subjects, and he will do this, we already know this, he's injecting himself into the investigation, like Dennis Rader, who I interviewed, like David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, who I interviewed, like the Zodiac case, whose case remains unsolved. So we provided that to him, and then he took it back to Lexington, told the sheriff, and they went public, and they said, we went to the FBI, we know who we're looking for. We just have to find him. I will not personally get involved in the case where I'll provide on-site consultation until Sherry's sister, Dawn, gets a call, because he's focusing in on the other sister now. And he tells her, do you know about this Deborah Helmick case? And she says, what? The Deborah Helmick case, a 9-year-old. And yes, and then he gives directions. This little 9-year-old was abducted in front of her trailer. Her and her parents just moved into. Her dad was home that day. And she was abducted about 50, 60 feet from the front of that trailer and drives off with her. So he's giving directions now to Dawn on where to find, where just like he did with Sherry Faye Smith, the specifics of where we can find her body. And that's what happened. We cops went out there. They found the body. Now the call comes in from the Lexington police to the our South Carolina FBI office in Columbia, South Carolina, requesting on-site consultation. And so that's when I go, and I get a relatively newer agent in the unit, Ron Walker, real solid guy, but relatively new in the unit, to go with me down to South Carolina. We go down to South Carolina. We meet the sheriff again, under sheriff. They take us to all the different locations, and particularly the last case, the Deborah Helton case. And the problem, the sheriff says, is that the killer stopped calling. He stopped calling, and we need him to call. And the subject, the unsub here, knew enough to stay off the phone. He'd have to stay on the phone 15 minutes for us to do a traps and trace on the telephone back then. And he would get off the phone and within minutes sometimes, knowing that would be out there. And we would find, where he called from a pay telephone booth, we'd process that and send it to the lab, the coins and everything, looking for any potential, anything forensically off of him. But so I tell him, when he tells me he stopped calling, I said, I'll get him to call. You'll get him to call? Yeah, I'll get him to call. But one thing I want to do is I want to meet the family. Number two, I want to meet with an investigative reporter. And so what happened is I go out to the family, and Robert Smith is a lay minister. He works in counseling, inmates. Even he was a potential suspect at one point, we're thinking, or someone he came in contact with in the prison. This is retaliation, perhaps, against him. But we quickly eliminated that idea. So it's a terrible situation. Everyone's distraught, obviously, crying, and you're coming in on this, and I meet everyone, and they thank us, like me, and for trying to help, and I said, I think I can come up with some idea, but I'm kind of hemming and hawing, Dan. I'm not really. Should I tell him, or should I suggest this idea? And the idea is, and I say, Mr. Smith, is that I can tell, and you can probably tell, is that this person, this on sub here, is focusing his attention on your other daughter, now Dawn. And I think we got to get him to talk. I think we can get him to talk if I can work with Dawn and give her some skills that we use in hostage negotiation. And he was afraid. He said, what if he comes in this and tries to kill my daughter. I said, this guy's a coward, Mrs. Smith. He's not the type who's going to pull up into your driveway here, and everyone will be protected. And so he agrees to this, and then Dawn takes me into Sherry Faye Smith's bedroom, and where she's a collector of koala bears. She had dozens of koala bears, and I see one, and I'm kind of thinking in my head, what can I do here proactively? And I'm thinking ahead of the funeral, a memorial service. So I take one of the koala bears, a real small one, about 3 inches, where the type where if you squeeze the back of its shoulders, the paws open up, and then you let go and it closes. And so that koala bear I'll be using at a memorial service, where I'm going to have Dawn place that koala bear on a flower. And I'm going to have a podium painted white, and going to have a picture of Dawn in the podium. And why am I doing that, Dan? Is that from so many of the interviews I've done, offenders, they will take souvenirs and trophies, we call them, from their victims. And when they go back to the scenes, or they go back to the cemeteries for various reasons. In the case of Ted Bundy and some others who I and my colleagues interviewed, they have sex with the victims, even through advanced stages of decomposition. Others go back to symbolically kind of roll in the dirt, that this nobody, this insignificant nobody now is becoming infamous as a serial killer. So they kind of fantasize and relive it. So here, the goal was to get the guy to call. And I worked with an investigative reporter to poetically describe what was going to be taking place and what took place at that cemetery. And then we're going to be monitoring all the vehicles. Unfortunately, and we had no control over this, she'd be buried very close to the road, within 100 feet, and which would be risky on the part of the subject. But the police would be taking down license plates. And we would later, moving ahead for a second, we will later know if we won't catch him the way we will ultimately catch him. We would have came up with his name because he did in fact drive by and he stopped and we got his plate, and then we would have done criminal checks on all these people and would have found out that this guy, Larry Jean Bell, had his so-called criminal history. One of the things, if you don't mind me keep talking, unless you want to jump in, Dan, but is the with the calls where and the last will and testament that he made, Sherry Faye Smith wrote, saying goodbye to her mother, her father, her brother, Robert, boyfriend Richard, and she's going to be with Jesus now, and I want to have a closed casket, not an open casket. So she knew she was going to die. She knew what was going to happen to her body, and how someone could write a letter, like this. When I talk to Mr. Smith, even to this day, we communicate with each other. There's no such thing as closure in cases like this. We always talk about closure. An arrest been made, the guy's been, but it really never really closure. How can you? Okay, you have an arrest, but that doesn't bring back my daughter. But the only thing he felt somewhat a bit of closure was from that last will and testament. Knew how strong her daughter, or his daughter, was when to write that, and knowing that she's going to be with God, and that helped him psychologically. It didn't not so much with the mother, and she would die not too many years thereafter. And I've seen that in so many cases where it's just unbearable what they go through, like Patsy Ramsey in the JonBenet Ramsey case, whose cancer returned. And what made this guy not just a serial killer but a sadistic serial killer, it was the taunting of the family. And then when he talks to the mother, Hilda, on this one call, and he tells the she asks him, did my daughter know she was going to die? And he says, yes, and I gave her a choice. And your daughter was given the choices of gunshot, drug overdose, or suffocation, and your daughter selected suffocation. And that's when he duct taped her head. And she says, oh my God, how could you do this to my daughter? Oh, please have God forgive us all and forgive me. And then he hangs up on her. And so this guy is not a type, generally a type of serial killer would work. He goes beyond the killing, the sexual assault, to the taunting, the police taunting the family and giving them false hope. And then through the middle of all this, and he's calling out, he calls and speaks with Dawn, and he says, and in so many words, what he's telling her is, you can't be protected forever. You know, one day, 1 month, 1 year, like, you're next. You're going to be, be next. So it was important, you know, so important to solve the case. The pressure was just, unbelievable. Meanwhile, at the lab, the letter, the last will and testament that the victim, Sherry Smith, wrote, is being processed in the lab for hair and fiber evidence. And they're also using a technique which will attempt through some electrostatic device. They put a chemical on the paper. They search for indented handwriting. And so if we have the last will and testament, maybe there were sheets of paper on top of that Ansub ripped off before he made her, write the last will, in testament. And so we're, we're on site working with the family, police and everything. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, when they contact us in this motel we were staying at, they got a great lead, on the case. And what the lead is that the lab was able to come up with what appeared to be first a grocery list on a sheet of paper that was on top of that last will and testament, maybe several sheets on top of that last will and testament, as well as a telephone number. And a telephone number, the area code would take them to Alabama, and the prefix of the number would take them to Huntsville, Alabama. And then all but one digit was missing. And through the process of elimination, they came up with a telephone number that would take them back to the Lexington, South Carolina, to a family known as the Shepherd family. And everyone is ecstatic, the Shepherd family. The undersheriff goes out with detectives and knocks on the door, believing that they're going to be knocking on the door of the killer here. But here comes to the door a middle-aged man. He's 50-ish. And his wife, same age, and they're kind of initially they're disappointed. They go inside and this guy doesn't fit the profile here. And they find out that this Mr. Shepherd is an electrician, and he's been away for 6 weeks in California. And he tells them that while he was gone, had someone house sitting here, and it was an employee of mine, an electrician, and his name is Larry Jean Bell. And they provide him a profile, the FBI profile that we did, and the family, the husband and wife, they look at each other and they say, "That's you're describing Larry Jean Bell." And then they played a sample of the audio tape of the call that he was making, and they said, "That's him. That's him. Can we see his bedroom?" And they said, "Yeah." And he slept over here, so they go into the bedroom where Bell was staying. Also, he looked for a gun. Mr. Smith Shepherd left a weapon, a gun, and it wasn't in its usual place in the house. When he did find the weapon, it was recently discharged, they determined. And we felt that she was probably, when Sherry Faye was abducted, the guy had a knife or a gun there. They removed the mattress, and under the mattress is a woman in a bound up, and spread eagled with tape on her, and this is in between the two mattresses. So now, what's going to happen next? Please, unless you want to jump in, Dan. I'm talking a lot. I'll tell you how we proceed now into the interrogation, if you want.
The evidence in the break, I just cut you off. Sorry, but about the condition of the what you surmised from going into the bedroom of the Shepherd trailer. Again, give us what you surmised, what you found.
Okay, within the Shepherd house, was, they would find a handgun that Mr. Shepherd had, which was misplaced. Someone removed it. It was probably Bell, Larry Bell, who was staying there, and underneath the between the mattresses was this pornographic magazine, and the magazine on the cover was a woman in a crucifix position, and but bound up in a crucifix in a bondage type of position. So pretty much, they got the guy now. They got Bell. Now, whether or not he's going to testify, that's another question, because in South Carolina, you have the death penalty. And it makes it really difficult to get a confession out of somebody unless you provide some type of face-saving scenario. So they're going to haul him into the police station. But I tell the sheriff that they didn't have a task force room. So I said, you have to create a task force room. And so what they had was a trailer outside back that they got in a drug deal. And they were able to confiscate that from these drug dealers. And what we did, we made that trailer into a command center within a couple of hours. Right. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. You put on signs, a major crime task force office. Inside the trailer, we had files upon files of it appeared that how, just to show how thorough the investigation was, with his name on these file cabinets, victims' names on the file cabinets, maps showing with like tape from the point where Bell lives to where the abduction of the victim took place, down back to where the Shepherds live, all these lines, everything leading to Bell. And so we did that in a couple of hours. We're not going to be initially involved in the interviews, Dan, because if you got so involved in all like the interviews, you'd be doing, you wouldn't be able to work your cases back sure. at Quantico. You'd just be testifying, all the time, flying around the country. So you try to pick some who would best be the right person, for a particular interview, whether it's going to be male, female, right. a certain age group, whatever. So we do, something like that. And we had two very experienced detectives and who we felt could provide, maybe some type of face-saving scenario. So they make an arrest of Bell early in the morning. He's back living with his parents. We actually included that in the profile as well. And they take him. He's 35 years of age. Everything fits. The other thing too, mm-hmm. when I left out, is that what the Shepherd family said is that when Larry Jean Bell picked us up at the airport, and we picked us up at the airport, we hardly could recognize him. And why is that? Because he lost weight and he grew a beard and he looked so different. And he was just seemed preoccupied, and he was just obsessed about this case, about these two young girls being murdered. In fact, when he got back to our house, he had newspaper clippings. He saved us newspaper clippings to look at these and read about these, two cases. So they make the arrest. And that is where they arrest him. They find because he was so obsessive compulsive, and that was part of the analysis too, and how structured right. he was. That when he went looked in his closet, everything was lined up and neat and orderly. Everything in his vehicle, same way, highly maintained and rigid. In a garage, tools, it would be like guys like him, we would say, would outline a screwdriver like in paint, and so the screwdriver goes here, and the hammer goes there over here, and they arrest him without incident. They take him to the trailer. We're not in the trailer. We're police going to do this. We're with the sheriff and the undersheriff and the prosecutor, which he calls solicitor, Donnie Myers, is his name down in South Carolina. His nickname was Dr. Death. He had so many death, murder, and death convictions down there, capital punishment convictions. So we're waiting, we're getting debriefed, and they're really not getting anywhere. And we leave. We're me and my partner. We're in the undersheriff's room, and everyone else now is in the sheriff's room, and solicitor, Sheriff Metz, and the undersheriff. And all of a sudden, without warning, the door opens up, and here is the prosecutor, the solicitor, with the sheriff, undersheriff, and the subject, Larry Jean Bell. We're not even knowing what was going on. And so the solicitor character, Donnie Myers, real southern drawl, says, Larry, he said, you know who these boys are? These boys are from the FBI, and they profiled you right down to a T. They know everything about you. And so Bell is just looking, and he's just looking at us. We're, you know, I'm looking at Bell, and this was, you know, this was not rehearsed or anything. And then they take off, leaving Bell behind. They leave him behind, and for us to talk, to him. So I said, "Hey, Larry, you know, take a seat." So he sits in a couch, and I sit on like a coffee table in front of him, but not really violating his space, you know, 5 feet, 4 feet away, and 5 feet away. And my other agent is back, you know, behind me, just standing, leaning up against a bookcase. And that day when I got the call early in the morning, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning about developments in the case, I threw on a pair of light colored pants, like white, almost white, and then a white shirt. So, which turned out perhaps a good thing because it looked almost clinical. And in retrospect, when I look back on the case, kind of like a clinical, like a first responder type of thing. So I got him in front of me. Now, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? So what I'm going to tell him, I was going to tell him about the research that I and my colleagues that we've conducted going into prisons around the country, avoiding words like titles like murderers, interviewing rapists or whatever, you know, just say interviewing inmates around the country for different crimes. And I talk about myself and, you know, my background. I don't want to have an interrogation. I just want to have this, like, I try to have a conversation and let's see how intent he is, because what he's doing, Dan, is that he's looking past me. He's looking to trial. He even said in one of his telephone calls to the family, he can't turn himself in. They'll electrocute me. I'll go to prison. They'll electrocute me. So that's what when you have somebody like him, that they're looking to that or the how they're going to be perceived in prison. Here, this guy's a child killer, perpetrating two homicides, and he's going to be suspect to this day, in two other homicides that are unsolved in South Carolina, where he had close contact with each of these those victims. So I go through all this, and I tell him, I said, one of the things I found out when they said it was like almost like two sides of them. That one side of them didn't even know the other side. Like, as if, you know, do you ever hear multiple personality? I told him, Larry, where one side does something to the surprise of the other, may not even have any knowledge, you know, of it. And they wake up and have blood on them, or, you know, something terrible happened. So I'm trying to provide him this face-saving scenario. The only way he's going to try to get out of this is going to try, in my opinion, is to go an insanity route. And during that period of time in our country, multiple personality was kind of in vogue then. A lot of different killers used this. Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler, he tried to use this as a defense, and many serial rapists tried to use this, you know, as a defense. It was kind of in the in thing back then. It was all BS, but they tried it. So when I went through this whole process, you know, with him, and I then segue into, when did you start feeling bad about this case? Mm-hmm. And, you know, then I asked him, did you do it? When did you start feeling bad? And he said, when I looked in the newspapers and I saw the memorial service and the family.
Let's use an opportunity for this messages. So you were talking about his claims and what you could, in the conversation you were having with him, he was denying, but he was putting him in this third person character to say that Larry Jean Bell wouldn't do anything like that.
Right.
He kept denying.
How he concluded, what he said was, he says that the good Larry Jean Bell, you know, wouldn't do something like this, but the bad Larry Jean Bell, you know, could have. That's as far as he would go, you know, with that. I would testify to that, to the interview that I had with him in court. And then what I tried to do, which was that to bring him in front of Mrs. Smith and Dawn. And I did that. And I told Dawn, I said, Dawn, when you hear his voice, I want you to say, it's you. I recognize your voice. I know it. I know it's, you know, it's you. So the family comes in the sheriff's office, and then we bring him in to the family. Mr. Smith wasn't there. Mrs. Smith and Hilda and Dawn. He sits right in front of them. I'm kind of between them, and right in front of the family. And he starts talking, you know, say who your name is, Larry Jean Bell. And he starts talking. And as he's talking, she makes the comment about, it's you. I recognize your voice. You're the one I spoke to. And then he went into that, the good and the bad, Larry Jean Bell. You know, once again, what's amazing to me, Dan, is how the family, I don't think I could do it. Their faith, though, is just so strong. But they're able to sit in front of him like that. And I think I mentioned it in the book. I'm pretty sure I did. As I'm sitting there, I'm thinking to myself, did they search the families to make sure that they're not armed before they brought Mrs. Smith and Dawn in? I'm thinking to myself, my God. So now my toes, just in case, you know, if they're armed. And here right before me, this guy would be shot and killed by the family. And so, that's as far as he went there. And then the other thing you provide to, and people think all you do is just profiling. It's really, in a lot of cases, you just can't do it. We can provide so many aspects to an investigation. Who's the prosecutor, Donnie Myers. And I told him, yeah, so what do you think is going to happen, John? I said, well, what's going to happen? He's going to disrupt the very first day, because he comes in here, he's going to disrupt. He's going to be hooping, hollering, yelling, and why? Because his only hope is he's got to act like he's insane, that he's you know, it's crazy. I mean, his goose is cooked. We got so much evidence, you know, on him. And sure enough, first day of the trial, he comes in screaming, yelling, saying he's God, he's Jesus, and all this stuff, and then the trial proceeds, and I'm there during the trial, and you can watch him. He's just like when he was writing the script, when he would talk to the family, he followed a script. Here he is taking notes, copious notes during the trial, and he would be convicted of two counts. Well. The Helmick case would be tried separately, so abduction, murder, two counts, and he would be convicted in about, I think it was like 47 minutes or so. The jurors came back. It was really, really quick. And then when later on we had the Helmick case, it was the same thing. It was a very quick turnaround for the jurors. The thing that surprised me is how he died, Bill, is that he got the death penalty. You could take, in some states, a choice. Nowadays, the states that have the capital punishment, lethal injection or the electric chair. And he selected the electric chair. And it was just surprised me that this coward would pick the electric chair until I started thinking about it. And I thought, it more or less fits because when you commit a crime like this, committing perpetrating crimes against young people like this, you are low on the totem pole in prison.
Right.
In fact, you're not only going to get it from other inmates, but even the correctional guards are going to be treating you like crap when you get in there. And I just believe that he just wanted to show at the very end how tough he is, and that he's a real tough guy. He's no inadequate, type. And so he picked the electric chair. And like I said, 10 years later, he was executed. Had a criminal history, too, involving, all kinds of, he went to prison for a short period of time for abduction. And he had another, he was busted for obscene telephone calls against young children. Had he had not been caught, he would have gone on and on, and on. And what I really like about the case is really the police did a great job. And all you're doing is providing, an investigative tool and to help them. And that's why when I was in the Bureau it was really difficult in the beginning because the relationship, Hoover died in 72. I came back to Quantico in 77. I was the youngest agent at 31, just turned 32. And cops, you know, in those days, you know, the Bureau maybe basically looking for credit where credit isn't and wasn't due in cases that really the locals did. And so what my goal was, and I accomplished, and for us and the people, we always give credit. Even if you think we played a bigger role than we did, give credit to,
right,
you know, to the police and the work they've done. And and they did do a great job in the laboratory. And unfortunately, it doesn't always, all cases don't always happen, you know, that way. But you know, it was a tremendous case. But emotionally, I had a daughter, age of Deborah Helmick at the time. And it was just, you know, upsetting. You know, like I said, I'm just trying to get over all the stuff I went through in 1983 and 1984, the stress and the nearly dying. And now I'm back in again. I have people in the unit, which is great, but it's like any business. It takes a while to learn the business. Takes you probably about 2 years to feel kind of good about it, and then maybe 5 years before you feel real comfortable. And in my job, and the people who didn't do what I do, usually by 5 years, they start getting burned out, and they want out. They can't take it anymore. They want to move on to somewhere else in my organization. And it just that's probably the. It took an emotional toll, and to this day, I have contact with Mr. Smith. They established a fund for the daughter, a scholarship fund. It was in music and art. That's what she was going into when she would go to the university. And just a wonderful man. Just their faith is so strong. Just very, I mean, even forgiving, you know, him. And even Hilda at some point too, before she passed away, forgave him just to get it out of her brain, you know, and try to move on with their lives. And then Dawn is today. She's a spiritual leader. She sings the gospel, and she's made albums. She's affiliated with churches. She just does public speaking. Just a wonderful family.
She won the beauty pageant shortly after, too.
She ran
Bell Preventer,
Miss South Carolina. And she was like runner-up in the USA pageantry, but just really terrific. It breaks your heart, those kind of cases. But like I said, Dan, I just never, you have like Raider contacting the police and, you know, that kind of stuff, and or Berkowitz, you know, but this... And they're all the inadequate types, but this is, you know, one step. Although Raider, he's in a sadistic mode, you know, too. But this guy goes is way beyond, you know, you know, that. And just never had a case. I don't know of any other case quite like that. You'll have cases. You know, you're from Canada originally, right?
Yes,
Dan.
Yes,
and the Clifford Olson case up there. Remember Clifford Olson, who killed the children?
Yes.
He killed like 10 children, and then he taunting the police. He would call me at the FBI, and I guess the Canadians were up in air about it because they didn't know where the victims were. He killed like 10 children, and they made a deal with them, giving them $10,000 per victim, and a lot of the Canadians were up in arms about that. They didn't like that, but they never would have found these victims had they not
done that.
But this guy, he thought he was Hannibal Lecter, Clifford Olson, when he was contacting me. They had him in a plexiglass cell like Hannibal Lecter. And the only reason he was in the plexiglass cell is because the other inmates would throw cups of urine and feces on him. It was because he was some badass guy. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't believe it. He was calling me on a cell phone. He had he was calling me on the phone. He would give him a phone even at that time. This was in the 90s. He had in the 90s, he had some type of TV, computer, but he was trying to tell me that he was the Green River murderer and try to convince me. And why do you want me to convince me? Is because he wanted out of the prison. He wanted like a little break, and me following him around, the detectives, and out in King County, would be, you know, trying to where the bodies are. what a manipulator, you know, he was. He died not too many years ago in prison. Good riddance to him.
Yes, he was. Fascinating about this book, among so many fascinating things, is the importance of this correspondence, especially the last will and testament that this sadistic killer, who loved to taunt the family and her sister and
mm-hmm.
police and the community, but he had her write out this last will and testament, which she, as you write, showed such incredible composure and courage in the last note to her family, trying to make them feel brave and said things like, I don't want this to ruin your life. And that correspondence, like some energy from beyond, was the thing that sealed this killer's fate.
Right. Yeah, if it wasn't for that, who knows? I mean, maybe eventually, like through the license plate, you know, there could have been more. I mean, the very least would be more victims. He would still be taunting Don, because then he shifts his attention to Don, as you know, Dan. And, if 1 month, 1 day, 1 month, 1 year, you're next, you can't be protected forever. And then getting back to the last will and testament, then she knows she's going to die. And she talks about she wants a closed casket. She knew, because what was going to happen to her and how she would end up. And one of the reasons too, Dan, told you that this guy had his criminal sophistication or certainly knowledge of crime. He would wait several days, 3 or 4 days, and it was really hot when we were down there, really hot and humid. And by waiting several days like that before pointing out the bodies, and we knew he had to go back because he gave these precise directions where we can find the victims' bodies, that he wanted the bodies to be in an advanced state of decomposition, which they were. And so we really couldn't determine whether or not there was a sexual assault or how the victims were killed. With Dawn, with Sherry, we had that some residue on the face. We could tell that duct tape was used with her, and probably suffocation was the cause of death. But Mrs. Smith, even with the last will and testament, Dan thought that there was still hopes that she may still be alive. And he just, he's calling the family saying, I know who you are. I know the family, and that's why I can't give myself in. And then he gives a description of his car, which it was not his car. He has a red car. They almost caught me the other day. All this stuff. He just got so caught up in this manipulation, and which is a downfall. I mean, that was the downfall of Rader. He gets caught up in this. They reaches a point where they feel invincible. We're just so stupid, law enforcement. We can't catch you. Had Rader held tight and not reached out like he did. The investigation wasn't really, close to nabbing him at all. It wasn't until a stupid jackass communicating with the police, asking the police, do you think would you be able to, if I submit a disc to you, could you trace it back to me? And he's doing this, sending messages in the newspaper. And so what do you think the police are going to say? Oh yeah, we can trace it back to you. No, he says, no, we can't do that. So just his stupidity. And they pretty much had about the same IQ. They're not bright. Neither Rader or this guy Bell were not any bright light in the attic. Not at all. And they were lucky. They were lucky up to a point. But that was his downfall, was that when he sends, as you know the case backwards and forwards, and you've had other guests on talking about the case, that case that was the floppy disk, and you didn't have to be any kind of a computer whiz to decipher it. And right there was the name of the church, a church, I think it's Christ Baptist Church or something like that. And then the president was Dennis Rader. It was the president. So unfortunately, with some cases, we are stymied. You're stymied, and to keep them going, you want them to keep communicating. But just when they stop, like the Zodiac, when they stop, and then you don't really have anything going, it's difficult. I don't know if you probably don't know this, or your listeners, but the Zodiac, the only time we got involved in the Zodiac is when the police contacted us, because a letter, we hadn't heard from the Zodiac in a long time, and they said, we got this letter. from the Zodiac, and we're going to send it back to you. We no sooner get the letter, it's followed up by a telephone call. Forget the letter, forget about it. Why? Because the detective working the case, were involved in the case. One of the detectives wrote the letter. What? To perpetuate the case. He hadn't heard anything from the officer, so he was trying to create, some new kind of lead, because you have nothing at all. And David Berkowitz writing the letters, you're having something to analyze, but the device that was used in this case, it wasn't developed for the back then yet on the for Berkowitz, like analyzing the letters, the indented writing type of stuff, or the fingerprinting. It wasn't as sophisticated as it is today, like back then. So today's all automated analyzing prints.
Yeah, so you talk about this, that this was a very fortunate combination of following the profiling, and also the latest forensic science methodologies, and the strategies that you would employ, like you say, were the thing that led him to do certain things. You prompted him to do certain things via the media and the cooperation with the sheriff, and so you successfully brought this person to justice. I want to thank you very much, John Douglas, for coming on and talking about When a Killer Calls, A Haunting Story of Murder, Criminal Profiling Justice in a Small Town. I want to thank you very much for coming on and doing this interview.
Thank you, Dan.
This book
Thanks
will be released.
Me.
I know this book will be released February 1st, and I'm sure
yes,
it will be available everywhere. Again, thank
yes,
you so much, John Douglas, for coming on and talking about When a Killer Calls. It's been a
thank
pleasure.
You.
Thank you, and good night.